Hello and welcome to episode 134 of Just Get a Real Job. I'm of course your host, Jamie McKinley, and this is a podcast where I attempt to demystify the creative industries by speaking to a wide range of creatives at different points in their careers. We've got a really interesting episode in store this week, and it's the first time on this podcast I've actually had a colleague on as well. And joining us on the show is the wonderful Adair Murray. And like many of the guests, and like many of you people listening will relate to, Adair is very much doing two different sort of creative things at the same time. So Adair is a full-time senior script editor who I work alongside on River City, which is obviously BBC Studios' continuing drama for anyone outside of the UK listening. And Adair is also a musician, and it was really interesting to chat to him about sort of how he does both of those things side by side. Adair's had a really, really interesting life as well. He moved to London when he was 16 to sort of pursue a career in music before later coming back to Scotland. We get into all that in this conversation as well. It's packed full of lots and lots of wisdom from Adair as well. I really, really enjoyed recording this one. It's always really special getting to chat to people who you know and getting to find out a bit more about them and stuff as well. And even though I sit next to Adair at work, there was things I found out about him in this episode which I didn't know before. So, no, it's a really interesting chat. Lots and lots of great pearls of wisdom in there as well. Adair's got lots of new music out, which we're also going to chat about in this episode. There's some links in the episode as well. You'll get to hear a bit of the songs. But there's also links to all of Adair's current work below the podcast as well. And before I forget, I just want to quickly give a particular shout out to our colleague Cara, because I promised her I would, and she's been supporting this podcast for a couple of years as well, so much appreciated. Shout out to the rest of the River City colleagues if you're listening as well, because I know you'll be pulling me up for not mentioning yous as well. It genuinely makes a massive difference having a good team of people to work with, so appreciate all of you lot. You're a good bunch. One thing that me and Adair didn't get into enough chat about, which we did mention at the start of our conversation, is a bit about script edit and what a script editor does. I know I've sort of mentioned that on the podcast before, but we'll hopefully get Adair back on in future and we'll go into a bit more depth on that. But there's lots and lots of great other topics we cover today. Anyway, without much further ado, this is episode 134 of Just Get a Real Job. Enjoy. Creative industries are merely mess. Artists lather goods are torn to shreds. The government will spoil your hopes and dreams by offering a useless retraining scheme. Such amazing talent, why can't you see that the government has decimated the industry? And now the years of hard work could be thrown away. And people who don't care, well, they will say, just get a real job. Adair, thank you for coming on the podcast. This is a bit of a weird one because we're doing this in person at our work.
Doing it in person. Thank you for having me on the podcast. I'm a big fan, so it's
a pleasure.
An honour to be on it.
It's the first time I've ever had a colleague on the podcast as well.
Oh, well.
So for any listeners that don't know, me and Adair work together at River City. Adair's technically my boss.
No, don't say that. I hate that. That makes me sound like an adult, and I'm definitely not one of those.
Well, we've got lots of interesting things to talk about tonight, and it's also weird because we're recording this in a dressing room at River City, which
we
is...
We are. Yes.
Quite.
We don't say who's.
No, we won't say. They'll never know. They ever do listen to this, but it feels oddly professional. But do you want to sort of start by introducing yourself just for the listeners? Because you're sort of straddling two careers. You're a musician and you're a senior script editor at River City.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, as you say, I kind of do both just to be involved in the creative industries as much as possible. I mean, I love. Both of them come from loving my love of storytelling, so that's kind of what I enjoy about both elements of both jobs. Writing songs is a big part of storytelling for me, and the lyrics and stuff, and then script editing I found my way into, and that's why I love that as well, is telling stories and getting them on the telly.
Well, you're also the first script editor apart from myself that I've had on the podcast, because the listeners know from me talking about what I've done for a job for the last few years a bit about that.
Yeah.
So we can maybe talk about that in a bit more depth as we go on.
Yeah.
And you've obviously had quite an interesting life from the snippets I've heard from knowing you over the last sort of 9 months or so. So I'm interested to sort of go back through some of the journey. I know you've lived in London, cool. You've lived in LA, you've been around.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got some cool things
Thanks,
to say.
Thanks, Jamie.
I didn't mean in a negative sense.
No, I know, I know. Around. Yeah, no.
He's been around the block.
Yeah, and also script editing, like you say, is a job not many people know exists, what it is, and people, I didn't know before I started doing it what it was either.
Yeah, neither did I, and I think a
sometimes
lot of people,
I'm still not sure. I know
yeah,
exactly
we make it up
is,
on the fly, yeah. Especially on a continuing drama.
Yeah.
But I suppose a good place to start is like with your earliest creative memory. So take us back. What was young Adair? What was young Adair like?
Young Adair, well, so I grew up in a small village called Bonnybridge, which is out near Falkirk, and there wasn't really, like, probably a lot to do when you're a wee guy, and most of the wee guys that I knew were playing football, and I just wasn't really interested in that. So what I used to do, which was my first sort of foray into music really as well, was I was a big fan of like pop music and the charts and taping the charts on a Sunday and like being raging at my mum and dad if they ever took me out anywhere on a Sunday because it meant I would miss the charts or we'd have to have it on in the car basically. But I used to buy, and I still do, buy a lot of music. So probably my earliest creative thing was when you would buy, this is going to show my age now, but when you would buy a single, a CD single or a cassette single or whatever, sometimes the B-side would be an instrumental of the song. And so what I would do is I would play the instrumental over and over and over, but write my own new lyrics over it. So like write my own version of the song basically, and then obnoxiously perform it for my whole family in the living room.
So are you always like loving to sing and do that growing up? Are you always sort of, any chance to get on stage sort of thing, were you always taking that?
Yeah, I think it's always just been telling stories really is what I've loved to do. And like, so the writing of the lyrics was, I think, just being like lost in my imagination as a child, I suppose. I grew up watching a lot of TV. I grew up watching a lot of soaps. And so just kind of, that's kind of, like, I used to write my own scripts and me and my best friend Leanne would act them out. You know, just stuff like that. Just always wanting to tell stories. And as I say, I wasn't out playing football and stuff like that, which was the norm for where I grew up. So I sort of used my imagination to have my own fun, basically.
And you think, like, the expression, like, did you feel you were able to express yourself at that time? Because you told me a bit about growing up, and that didn't sound like an easy time either.
No, it definitely wasn't. So I think it's weird. Like, I had a really great time in my younger years because we grew up in, as I say, a small village. So when we were really young, all the kids in the street sort of played together. So, I mean, I used to even get other people, other boys and girls in the street that I played with to, like, act out the scenes as well. And, me and my best friend Leanne. But it was when you got to that older age of like hitting high school, that was when sort of everything changed and things sort of took a bit of a darker turn in terms of being singled out as just being different and being called, you know, a sissy or whatever, just because purely because I didn't play football. Because football was the thing that...
It was like the expression of...
Yeah, that was the boys' thing that everyone did that bonded them together. And I just had never any interest in it. I mean, my dad, bless him, really did try. Bought me football boots. And then he caught me tap dancing in the kitchen with them on the tiles. So he gave up on that. He would take me up the park on a Sunday for a kickabout. But I would be really annoyed because we'd be missing the charts, so I'd be like, we need to be back for 4 o'clock to hear the countdown. So he kind of was like, okay, well, he's just gonna forge his own path anyway and do his own thing. And then it was one of those things of high school just was really difficult for me in terms of people singling me out and calling me names, gay and queer or whatever, before I even really knew what those words meant. So that was tough.
And do you think that's actually, like, looking back, is that feeling different influence a lot of your work now and, like, your singles and things?
Yeah, I mean, I know you kind of touched on it earlier, but, like, so I escaped all that as soon as I could, basically. And after I'd done my exams at school at 16, I actually went to London against my parents' wishes. And, you know, they wanted me to get a job and all that kind of stuff, but they weren't really aware of any, really, of the trouble that I went through at school, because I didn't really, no kid wants to tell their parents I'm being bullied or picked on, because you kind of feel embarrassed about it, although I shouldn't have done. So I went away to London and sort of found myself there, and I had a real disconnect with where I was from for a really long time. I really hated where I grew up and I would say to people, I'm never going back there, and no one there understands me, you know, that really, like, I'm a tortured art.
But having that very common, I felt that a little bit growing up. Look, when I first moved away from my hometown, and from interviewing loads of people, it's quite a common thing, especially if there wasn't really a lot there for you.
Yeah.
Especially as creative people, like, I think growing up in smaller places, it doesn't tend to be that place for you to express yourself fully or be accepted. And
yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because the next question I was going to ask you is about how where you're from has influenced you, but has that relationship changed? Like, as an adult now, have you got a much more of an attachment to that place?
Yeah, I found when I moved back from London as an adult, I reconnected with, one, the place that I'm from and the few people that I sort of kept in touch with from my childhood. And I really feel the support from those people in that place now who have encouraged me to do well with music. Or, you know, if, for example, if there's an episode of the show that they've enjoyed, they'll message me and say, you know, oh, congratulations, oh, it's really exciting to see your name up there in the credits, or anything like that, really. I feel like people have kind of, I always felt people were against me there, but actually they're not. I was against myself. It was my own issues that I had to get over that stemmed from the bullying and all that kind of stuff. But actually the people and the place, I feel, have been a really big support of mine and what I've done as an adult, really.
No, it's an interesting one, and I'm interested to ask, what did London have at that time that, I mean, that must have been, I'm interested about that time in London, because
yeah,
you moved there as a 16 year, that's very young.
Yeah.
You sort of went there to also make music too, right, as well as that. I know you're finding yourself in lots of other ways, but
yeah,
was a sort of goal at the time, I'm going to go there and I'm going to become, do you ever tell me, you used to write to all these labels and you used to phone all these music labels and were very determined, you know, 15, 16 year old, which I think is unusual.
Can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, of course, swear away.
Fucking bonkers is what it is, because my niece is now 13, and if I think that in 3 years' time she was to come to me and say, Uncle Adair, I want to move to London on my own, I would be like, get upstairs to your room and listen to Little Mix and don't come out until you've really thought about this. So the bonkers thing as well was that I'd only ever been to Glasgow once. So the only time I'd been to Glasgow was when my sister brought me on a train to sign up with an agent, an acting agent, at the age of like 13 or something. We'd got the train through, and I remember walking up Renfield Street and being like, oh my God, this is the biggest city I've ever been in my life. Now I walk up Renfield Street and I'm like, oh my God, it's a dump. But like, I just loved the city vibe even of being in there. So I was really lucky that I had a cousin who lived in North London, and basically, so I'd been to visit a few times and I'd seen like just stupid things like the music shops on Denmark Street, the lights at Piccadilly Circus, the massive HMV store that was on Oxford Street. Like, to me at that time, those were like Mecca to me, you know what I mean? Like, that was just like, I had to be where that was all happening. So I was really determined from a young age that I wanted to make music. So my dad, to his credit, when he gave up on the football, basically my dad as a panel beater, so worked in a garage in Bonnybridge, and he had heard through a friend that there was a guy who did music in the village, basically. So he was like, please help my son. Please get him out of the house. Please, like, just do, you know, help him do something. So I was really lucky that I partnered up with him. His name was Johnny Peebles. And we wrote a song, my first song together, like the age of 14. It was called Move It, which I won't even tell you what the lyrics were, but they were really cringe. But it was the first song that I'd ever written. And then he also taught me how to DJ. So I was DJing from a really young age. There was a really well-known Scottish radio DJ at the time called Tom Wilson, who has now sadly passed away. But he used to also come to Bonnybridge to teach me how to DJ. And I don't think I even realised at the time how huge that was. Like, he was like a DJ on 4th FM. He was really big and like... And the three of us just kind of had this little collective going in Bonnybridge, which is so random. And then from the back of that, I had this tape with this one song on it, Move It. We didn't have a house phone, but my sister did. So I used to sneak into her house and phone record labels in LA, record labels in London.
Did they sometimes get back?
Do you know, some of them were actually really polite and friendly on the phone. I think they could tell this was a child phoning, because I was like, I'd really love the opportunity to send you my tape. They must have been like, who is this kid from Falkirk? Like, what is he talking about? But I just was really determined from a really young age, and all I did was watch like MTV documentaries, VH1 Behind the Music, so I knew the people that I had to target. And I would get, at that time, CDs would have record labels details on them, so that's kind of how I used my brain to get all that information and then just cold call them. And sometimes I would send them tapes and I would get letters back saying, oh, you know, thank you so much for sending us your tape, and please keep us up to date if you do anything else. Most people would see that as a rejection, whereas I was like, anything else? Well, I'll show you what anything else will be. Like, I'll move to London and I'll do something else. So that was what drove me to London at such a young age, was like, I need to be where the music is. And also to start a new life where people didn't know me as the weird kid that, you know, everyone said was gay, basically.
And then they
were right. But I didn't discover that for a year or two later.
You weren't meant to feel accepted in that, as that person, though, and that's a problem.
Exactly, yeah. That was it.
When you were in London, because I know you brought an EP out in 2002 mm-hmm. called Adair.
Adair.
Mm-hmm. You know, self-titled one. Was that what you made when you were in London, or did that come later? Were you like actively making music there? Because I know you were working, you were doing all this stuff there.
So the EP came off the back of, so I was almost in S Club 7. I don't know, do you know S Club 7?
I know S Club 7, I didn't know this story.
Yeah, so
we've been saying for months, wait till I'm on your podcast.
I know, I thought I would save this for the podcast. So I'd only been in London for a couple of weeks and, you know, I'd left Scotland and everyone had said to me, you're going to suddenly realise the pavements aren't paved with gold and, you know, you're never going to get anywhere type thing. And then I'd been there for a couple of weeks and I got the Stage newspaper, which was an industry newspaper, and there was an advert saying that the person who put together the Spice Girls was looking to put together a new pop group. So I went to this open call at Pineapple Dance Studios in Covent Garden, and the audition process started. So I was there from 7 a.m. queuing. The audition started at 9, and as the day progressed, I was like, I seem to be getting through and getting through and getting through. And then I remember it being a case where there was, so John Lee, who ended up getting into the band, he was already pre-selected, so he was in the band already. So it was the other six that they were looking for, and so I got down to the last four boys. So it was between myself, Paul Bradley, and another guy called John. And I remember at the time being in the final round of auditions, which I think was in another place, and I remember thinking, they're all wrong. I'm gonna be able to phone them all and say, I'm in a pop group. And so I was devastated when I didn't get selected. I think a lot of it was to do with my age. I'd just turned 16 and they were also going to be filming a TV show to go with the band. So I think you had to be 18. I don't know, there was something to do with, but they were like, oh, we'll keep your demo tape on file and all that kind of stuff. But at that audition, I met a producer called Roger Benoit, who was a dance producer who had his own production company and studio up in Islington, and he had kind of approached me and said, we really want to work with you, do you write your own stuff? And I was like, well, I happen to have written Move It. You don't know it yet, but it's a classic. And so we just got on really, really well, and basically we wrote, I think, four or five songs, and some of them ended up being on that EP. But at that time as well, the studio that they had, there was loads of people coming in and out. Like at the time, like Mystique, the girl band, were coming in and out. People like Blue Cantrell, like American singers were coming in. So there was, it felt like there was like I was part of like a musical community, which is what I'd always been searching for. So what the music that came out of those sessions felt amazing, because they felt like I was part,
and it was professional. Part of something.
Yeah, it was professional and it was exciting, and it felt like I was still going to like boy band auditions and stuff and getting cut, and I remember thinking, oh God, like why am I doing this, going standing here queuing for hours on end to be told, sorry, your rendition of Westlife's Flying Without Wings hasn't got you through, when actually what I wanted to be doing was being up there and making my own stuff. So I was doing both, and I was getting creative fulfilment from one and then not from the other.
It's interesting that you sort of ended up working in two quite cutthroat industries, which are, we'll get into this in a bit, because I mean there'll be so many people listening, but when S Club 7 got quite big, how did you cope with like the idea that you were so close to it? Because I think that would have, I think a lot of people would at that point have been like given up, maybe.
I think I probably would have been devastated, and I remember opening the Sun newspaper. I worked in Costa Coffee at the time, and the paper had been delivered, and I was on my break, and I remember opening the centre spread of like, it was like Simon's Club something, because Simon Fuller was the manager who'd put them together. It was like a double page spread, and I was like, this is the band that I've been cut from. And I remember at the time thinking like, oh man, like that could have been me. But at the same time, I wasn't, because I was doing the stuff with Roger and Hank, so I was doing all this the my own music. So I was a bit like, okay, dust yourself off, keep going, basically.
Do you think as well that your age maybe helped you there? Because I think the older you get, you think things more, you maybe overthink things. Not everyone, I mean, just speaking for myself, but I do feel like the older I've got, I maybe think about things in a more analytic way, whereas when I was younger, I'd maybe just go off to
it. Yeah, I think you definitely, when you're young, you're fearless. And then I think you go through your 20s into your 30s, and then something happens in your 30s where it changes back, and you actually go, I don't give a fuck what anyone thinks of me anymore. I'm just going to, it's almost like midlife crisis of like reverting to type.
It's interesting how it all works.
I think your 20s are all about like failing and trying and being insecure. And then there's a confidence that comes with age as well. So it kind of, you kind of go back to the fearless side of it. Well, that's been my experience.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's all interesting. So with the Adair EP, like, when all that came out, how did that all go down? Like, how did you feel about it all?
So it was really difficult at the time because I didn't actually own the rights to the music at first, so I couldn't release anything. And the manager that I had at the time, the contract was confusing. So for ages, those songs were buried and weren't released. They were just sitting there as demos. And it was only, I think maybe probably about 10 years ago that I was able to actually release them. So it was kind of when the whole streaming thing kicked off, I managed to get the rights back to use them and own the music, basically. Because I co-wrote and co-produced all of them. So it's good to be able to... I mean, obviously, some of them, you listen to them now and the production does feel very 2002. Mm-hmm. But I still love them and I'm still proud of them as songs. And when I listen to, for example, the song Don't Give a Damn, I'm reminded of that person who was fearless, who was saying, I'm going to do this on my own terms and I don't care what anyone thinks. Why, when I care what you thought, look at me, look at everything you're not. I don't give a damn about the way it looks. I don't really care about what they say. I don't give a fuck for this shit. This time, I'm just doing this my way. When you're looking up at me, tell me what you thought you'd see. So what if I'm a little screw you too?
I suppose the other interesting part of this is like comparing then and now. Mm-hmm. So I know you're making a lot more music now. We'll talk about that in a bit more depth as well shortly. But like, what is the difference between the music industry then and now? Because it feels like, is it totally different? I mean, I know streaming's obviously a massive change.
There's good and bad, I think. Artists are able to be more in control. As an independent artist, you can decide when to put the music out. You can decide how much money you want to put behind a release. You're pretty much in control of everything. The bad thing is that you don't make money the way that you used to when you would have to go through the major label circuit of signing a record deal and a publishing deal. Because record companies and publishers, they're banks, essentially. Mm. So they bankroll your career and then you pay them back.
Yeah, I didn't know this till quite recently. I think when I interviewed Ross Layton from Fatherson last year.
Hello, it's Future Jamie here. I just wanted to quickly set the record straight. I realised I misspoke here. It was actually in a conversation with Brown Bear's Matt Hickman that I first heard about record labels being banks and giving artists advances and stuff. Just in case, I just wanted to, I just listened back and thought that's actually incorrect. So I just wanted to correct the record. Also did have a very good chat with Ross Layton for the 100th episode though, which I'd recommend you check out as well. But anyway, back to today's brilliant conversation.
So the first time I'd like heard of all that and properly, and I was like, whoa.
Yeah, when you sign your record deal or your publishing deal, you essentially get an advance, which people think is going to make you rich, but then unless you make a profit after paying that advance back, a lot of people get dropped from those deals if they've not been successful and they are out of money, basically. Which is why most people charge a fortune for their concert tickets now.
Because that's where the money comes from, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what pays it back, basically.
Unless you're in the top 10, like, artists that...
Yeah,
it's insane. The one good thing is, I suppose, it allows people like yourself to make music and control it and put it out in your own way.
Yeah, and I don't make it for any other reason now than to enjoy the music I'm making. And, you know, I don't have thousands and thousands of active listeners on Spotify, but it doesn't really matter because I don't owe anyone anything. Mm. So there's no pressure. The idea is that if people like the music and connect to the music, whether it's 20 people or 20 million, it doesn't matter. It's just about doing it for that reason, rather than feeling like, oh my, the pressure of being like, well, we need to write this song for radio because the record company are going to be like, well, they're not going to put that out as a single because it's over 3 minutes long. And, you know what I mean? There's so many things that people have to think about when they're involved in all that, that I feel lucky I don't have to think about.
No, I mean, I'm also interested in the time in London, like, after that. So what, because you moved back up here for a bit, didn't you? So talk us through that whole period. So from, like, after the EP and that period ended, like, what were you doing? Like, how did you sort of so gradually get into working on Hollyoaks and all that stuff as well?
Yeah, to speed the chunk up, basically. So I went on a journey with, like, my sexuality, basically, in London. I did eventually come out of the closet, which had a massive effect on the music industry and my success with it. I had a manager at the time who wanted me to stay in the closet for career purposes. I became really disillusioned with the whole thing because it felt like I was being asked to choose whether or not to be one thing or the other, and that ended up having an effect on the fact that I didn't really feel like I was being honest in terms of the output, because I was being involved in, well, you can't say this, and, well, if you want it to be on radio, you better keep it to this simplistic lyric and don't mention a boy in the lyrics, or, you know, and it better be 3 minutes and 33 seconds because that's the perfect length for, and I just felt like everything that I was working towards, I became really exhausted by it all. So I came home to Scotland and I moved to Glasgow and it totally just changed everything. I'd been working in clubs and stuff in London, but I'd been working as like a podium dancer and a flyer boy and stuff like that and a lot of the gay clubs in Soho. And then when I came back to Glasgow, I just discovered like real clubs. Like I found a real love for dance music and electronica, and I was at the Arches and going to nights in Glasgow at the time, like Club Noir, Utter Gutter, Death Disco, Pressure. Like I found a sort of little posse in Glasgow that people I worked with and stuff like that. So I sort of found my love for music again through that, although I wasn't making any music at the time. And then I went through a couple of like lost years where I was kind of making music for myself, but not really, didn't have the confidence after everything that happened to put it out. And then I basically went through a time of thinking, how can I do everything that I loved in music, which was storytelling, creating characters. Songs are essentially characters because not every song that I write is about me. So I started thinking about scripts, and as I say, I'd been writing scripts when I was a wee boy for me and my friends to act out. So I'd actually found quite a lot of them at the time as well, like in my mum and dad's house, in boxes, old Home and Away scripts that I'd written and all that kind of stuff. And I'd suddenly thought like that would be a great way of me being able to do what I love, which is tell stories. But it's not, I wasn't ready to get back into music. So I'd found in Glasgow the course at Glasgow Caledonian University, the MATV course, which was a master's in TV fiction writing. And it was run by Anne-Marie de Mambro and Chris Dolan, who are like hugely important Scottish TV writers.
And playwrights,
and radio plays. And they're just amazing. And I don't know how it happened, but for some reason they accepted me onto the course we had a class of 14. I was lucky enough to be one of those 14. And I basically had one of the best years of my life doing that master's, learning from Anne-Marie and Chris. And then again, straight after that, I think the week after graduation, I'd been given an interview at Hollyoaks for an editorial intern. So it was like really below minimum wage, basically. But I just was like, I have to get this, I have to do this. So I drove to Liverpool for the interview. And really embarrassingly, because I was running late, I don't know if I've told you this story before, but it was an assessment day. So it was like a storylining day, and then they would sort of assess you during the day and decide who they were going to pick. But halfway through the assessment day, one of the HR girls came in and said, "Do any of you drive a red Citroen?" And I was like, "I do." And she was like, "Oh, it's just that you're parked on the set and we need to film a scene."
Fucking hell.
So I had to go out and move the car and then come in. I was humiliated, so I sat back down, and basically the series producer at the time said, "We just had to hire you because you kind of came in and you did exactly what we would do," because it happens apparently quite a lot, because the park, there's limited parking, so sometimes you just have to park where you can and then move it. It was the fact that he said that I came in, didn't make a fuss, just went out, moved the car, came in, sat back in the interview, and then carried on with the pitching session. He was like,
it speaks to character. I think people forget that, because I mean a lot of people would panic in that situation. I'd probably have absolutely flussed. I'd get in a flap.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I thought I'd ballsed it up majorly. Yeah. I kind of left that interview going, oh well, who parks on the set, you know what I mean, an interview and then expects to get the job. But it all kind of, again, maybe it made me memorable, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's like that old story about, I mean, I reckon this is one of those stories that's been told so many times that every version of somebody retelling it is slightly wrong, but the actor that used to always say in auditions that he'd been bitten by a dog on the way or something.
Yeah.
And then like somebody had, like, I like auditioned them before and they were like, but you told me that story last time. It's like that. It's like, it does make you memorable, but yeah. It's like, fuck it out. The ground would just, you just want the ground to swallow you up.
I know. It was fun. And that was my first job in TV basically. And it was a 9-month paid internship, but I also worked at the Liverpool Empire Theatre at the weekend to make up, pay my rent, basically.
So you've always been a grafter then?
I've always had at least 2 or 3 jobs, yeah.
Which I think is important for people listening to this, especially if they're maybe musicians or, I mean, I know we're lucky at the moment, we work sort of full time and we have a salary, but that's actually quite rare in the creative industry.
Yeah, definitely.
For a lot of people, especially a lot of our listeners. And I suppose as well, you come in with a master's, like when I did my screenwriting master's at Green Academy Scotland, I didn't have a clue what a script that it was, really. Mm. Had a rough idea.
Yeah.
Was it like that for you working out on a continued drama like Hollyoaks? Was that the first time you're like, okay, this is very different to screenwriting? There's a lot of overlap, but.
What was great about that was, I mean, a lot of my thought process was I'll come out of this master's and somehow be commissioned a script for a TV show, which is just never really going to happen. So for me, it was like, how do I make money? And the internship came up. It was paying something. It wasn't paying a lot. I think like at the after tax, I was taking home like £800 a month. That's and my rent was 400.
We'd be able to live in that now. Yeah. That would get you like...
I know. So that's why I worked at the theatre at the weekend. But what the internship did was it gave me 9 months of going round all the editorial departments in a continuing drama. Mm. So I found out, for example, what researchers do. I found out what script editors do. Even silly things like I found out the difference between the series producer and a block producer, or what a production manager did. Or, you know, just I found out, basically, I went round all the departments and found out what everyone did, and also got a taster for what I might like, which was good as well, because I knew kind of from that I would enjoy script editing, but I knew that I didn't really want to be someone who was, say, for example, going down the AD role, because I could see where my strengths would lie.
I suppose the other interesting thing is, you were a bit older when you did that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that helped you? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that maybe go, oh, I'm a bit past it, like I'm not, you know. That must be intimidating, especially in such a weird industry like television, where it's a bit like, I don't know, it's a weird one if you're coming from the outside into that, it's a really hard industry to settle to.
Yeah, it definitely made me appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, people at Hollyoaks would sort of laugh at me because I was always first in and I wouldn't leave till everything was done. And I've always done that in terms of work ethic, to the one point where my friend David would always say, you do realise this place isn't going to burn down if you're not in the building. But I just always felt like I needed to be there, like in case, for example, the executive producer one day walked into the office and went, has anyone seen a dare? I did never want to not be there, you know what I mean? To be like, I'm here, in case I was ever needed for anything, or if anyone had a query. Like, I think it was just that, I think being older as well, like I felt like I wasn't 23, so I didn't have that thing of youth to go, I'm only 23, so I can make mistakes. I wanted people to know I was serious about this.
Do you think also having coming from the music industry, there's a lot of transferable skills you applied into that, or a lot of life experience as well?
Yeah, and as I say, one thing is I knew how competitive it was. So the fact that my foot was even in the door, I knew how important that was, because I knew how many people were waiting to get their foot in the door. It's not as bad as the music industry. I always say, like, the trying to make it in the music industry is like trying to chase a lottery ticket, because that's really what you're doing. You're hoping that your song all of a sudden, I don't know, ends up on a TV show that, you know, and then you have 12 million streams or whatever. But that is literally chasing a lottery ticket. So TV industry maybe isn't quite to that level, but it's still really, really difficult to get in. And once you're in, I think if you appreciate it and you work hard, there's a progression that you can hit.
Maybe more of a pathway, especially doing what we do in those other sort of, you know, script editor, editorial roles, or if you're an AD, for example, and stuff like that. I suppose it's maybe different if you wanted to be a screenwriter. That is maybe a bit more like the lottery ticket in music. It's maybe slightly... I don't want to say it's easier. I mean, there's slightly different industries. I think there's a lot of crossover. They're both very hard to navigate from the outside.
I think even if you want to be a screenwriter, though, I mean, you know, eventually I want to write, but that doesn't... I think you should still try and get experience. And
completely.
Don't you find that sometimes you speak to people and they go, oh, I just want to write, and it's a bit like...
Well, you're limiting yourself because you're not learning. You're not I'm just a pragmatist though. My advice to anyone listening is just be pragmatic. Like, I've always tried to be pragmatic. I'm the total opposite. Like, I'm not really interested in writing it. I'm not ever ruling it out, but you know, I love being a script editor for what that is, and you know, I get my fulfillment from doing this podcast and dressing rooms after work and stuff. But I suppose, like, yeah, it's an interesting one. But I do, I think you're right, it's like having that openness and not just going, I'm this thing. So most people interviewing this, like yourself, you know, they make music or they, and they also work in a theatre during the day, but they also do, like, they teach kids how to work in the arts. It's having those transferable skills, especially in a cost of living crisis where you need to make your creativity go far further instead of just specialising in one thing.
Well, creative people do what they do because they love doing it. That's the thing. Like, you get the fulfilment. Like, in terms of, obviously, you and I are earning a salary for our job, which is amazing, and we're really lucky for that. But the podcast and the music, you know, are we millionaires off the back of that?
I think I probably lose more money than I make from this. But that's not why I do it.
But exactly, that's what I mean. That's, you do it because you love do it, and it's, even if you put, so say for example, I was to put a song out today, and a year and a half down the line, someone discovers it and sends me a message on, I don't know, Instagram or something, saying, oh my God, I heard your song today and I really connected. Like, that's kind of enough, you know, of a thing, because you go, okay, it hasn't been for nothing. And yeah, all right, I might have spent money Facebook advertising this song at the time and no one listened to it, but at least it's found its way to someone, which is the whole point of doing something that's artistic anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, do you ever have that struggle though, where you're like, oh, at the moment it doesn't feel like there's much coming back, but then...
I don't allow myself to think that, because I think that's the biggest blocker to you continuing, basically. I think, I would say probably, if anyone that's listening wants to do anything creative, you have to believe in yourself to almost to the point of delusion. You do. It sounds silly, but you really do, because otherwise you have to be your biggest fan. And there's a little bit of ego involved in that as well, but...
Yeah, and also comparison's the biggest killer of creativity.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's like you compare yourself to other people, then it's the wrong approach.
Yeah, exactly. I'm older. I'm an old man now. So the other reason for me also wanting to do this new music is because I do feel like, who is making music for people my age, you know? So it's like loads of young people making music for young people, and that's great. But I'm not chasing that. I'm sort of hopefully telling more mature stories. And as I say, I'm not chasing the song has to be 2.5 minutes brigade, which feels truthful to me.
No, it's interesting. It's really interesting. I want to talk about your music in a bit more depth in a second, but like, you were at Hollyoaks for like 3 and a bit years in the end.
Yes, loved it.
And how was that? Was good overall? You enjoyed it?
It was brilliant. Yeah, it was my first job in telly. It was a great bunch of people that I had so much fun. As I say, because I went as the intern, and I sort of got to know everyone because I would go around all different departments. And I was really, really lucky. David Shields, who hired me with Gary Sewell, they really believed in me, basically. And Gary kept me on as a trainee script editor after the internship, which I was really lucky. So I was like, I remember saying to myself, even if I've only got 9 months of this internship, it's still better than nothing. Then they kept me on as trainee script editor. So I was really excited about that. And then I think I was trainee script editor for maybe a week, and then one of the script editors left and they were like, okay, you're not a trainee anymore. we'll make you a script editor. So that was great, because that was the first time in my life that I'd ever earned like a proper salary. So I remember thinking, oh, this is cool. Like, I can actually pay my rent and I've still got a wee bit of money left over at the end of the month. Like,
I can spend it on music.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to buy vinyl. And they used to laugh because I used to get vinyl delivered to the office like nearly every week. So yes, yeah, so I was there for that time as a script editor. Then COVID happened, and I basically packed a little suitcase, came home to my mum and dad's because I thought it was only going to be 3 weeks. And then basically when I came home, I basically decided that I wanted to put roots down somewhere, and I knew that I didn't want that to be Liverpool. I wanted it to be Glasgow. So when the time came, the opportunity came up at River City for script editor, and I applied and was really lucky to get the job. And
I've been here since.
Yeah, I've been here since, yeah. So yeah, it's kind of all happened, and I bought myself a wee flat in Glasgow that I love, and I don't think if I'd done any of that, I wouldn't have been able to even get back involved in music either. Like, it's all kind of happened sort of naturally. You see, until today, some blues dance floor.
talk about the music, because I know you've got quite a few new singles out over the last few. You've got, what, three singles have come out in the last six months?
Three have come out since October, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about them. Obviously, the first of them is Tool to Dance.
Yep.
And then you've done No Shame, which is the newest one.
Yeah.
And then my favourite, Untitled Love Song.
Yeah, everyone loves that one.
It's a great song. They're all good, but I think there's a particular one I like the most.
Yeah, all good. No, it's good. I'm glad you enjoyed them, yeah.
But tell us about that, because you were saying earlier that making songs for people your age and...
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously like 20 odd years since your first EP, so like it's interesting you can look back at the difference. I'm sorry to bring that up.
I was two when the first one came out. No, yeah, I mean, Tool to Dance sort of kicked it off, because that sort of was the message of what I was sort of feeling at the time. Was I'd gone through a breakup, and it was looking at relationships in a more mature way and going, that's ended, that broke my heart. And I'm now at an age where the thought of going back out to a nightclub or a pub or a dance floor and having to date or chat someone up, or 3 months in realise they're an absolute weirdo, and just having to go through all that thing, it was just that thing of I'm too old to dance, I'm too old for this, like I can't go back onto the dance floors and do that again. Just that feeling basically of, obviously no one's too old to dance and dancing's amazing, but it was just, it was more of a state of mind of being like, can I really put myself through starting again from day zero with someone else after investing so much time in the relationship that didn't work. And then Untitled Love Song, which has a really talented singer called Emily Wishart.
Yeah, amazing duet.
Yeah,
really,
she's great. She's studying in London at the moment at like the Royal School of Music or something. She's
lovely
fun
voice
to watch. Yeah, she's great. That was, again, from a mature point of view, looking back and realising a mistake that you'd made in a relationship that there was no way back from, basically. Whether that be, it's open to interpretation, it's whether, you know, you've cheated on someone and then in the spirit of youth you go, oh well, move on to the next thing, and then you look back on it and you go, actually, I really fucked that up, and that was a really nice person that I, like, that I ruined that with, and we could have had something nice. But
yeah,
when you're young you make mistakes, and then it's not until you look back on them you realise how colossal they were.
But if you park your car in the wrong place, it works out, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can go on a completely different career path, so it's fine.
And No Shame's the most recent one. That only dropped a few weeks ago, and you got quite, you know, it's got a choir and all that.
Yeah, big choir. So that's the big LGBT positive, hopeful anthem that I wanted to put out. And it's sort of like a semi-autobiographical thing about what I was talking about earlier, about growing up, feeling that shame of being different. And then the message of hope throughout it is like to live your life without shame and just be your true authentic self. And then the song ends with a really nice quote from Harvey Milk, which I wanted to include in it. So yeah.
Reminded me of Dare, because I didn't quite pick up on it at the time, because you were talking about quite a lot of stuff at once, but like you're talking about in the early 2000s, like not being able to, almost feeling that your career was compromised by the fact you weren't allowed to openly be yourself and have that career. I know that you know these songs, you're an independent artist now, you can have more freedom, but is the music industry completely changed on that? Like, would you feel like the times are better now on that, like in terms of representation? And I can apply that to TV as well, because I know you work in two industries. Like, do you feel like that is a lot better now, or is there still like work to do?
I definitely think it's better. I don't think it's perfect. I'm still seeing certain things that I see in terms of exploitation and imagery and stuff like that that worry me, especially with new artists coming through that maybe aren't independent. And I still see comparisons being made between artists, particularly, you know, younger female artists and things like that. I definitely think things in terms of representation are moving in the right direction. I love the fact that people are making the move from being major label artists to independent artists. I think Ray is a great example of that. There's loads of people who are going, actually, why am I bothering to line someone else's pockets and have someone else executive produce my music career in my life when I can, you know, when when a child dreams of being a musician, they're creating their story themselves from an early age. So the fact that then someone in a business suit takes over it and goes, to give you your dreams, I must, and give you the money, I must control everything. Like, I think people are realising they don't have to compromise that, and they're moving, just making the switch from labels to independent, which is great.
No, it's really interesting. And another thing to fly as well, where I suppose both industries have collided for you in both your careers, but your song was on an episode of River City quite recently.
It was.
That must have been quite special to have a song on TV for both of your creative endeavours to meet in the middle like that.
Totally.
Quite rare.
In the fucking iconic Tall Ship pub in Shield Inch. Thank you very much, to direct to Ryan Graham for including it. No, it was brilliant. It was really exciting. Those are the kind of things that you think about when you're young and you go, oh my God, one of those days, hopefully my song will be on this or that. So that was a big moment and really exciting, and I'm grateful to the worlds for colliding.
And for the people listening as well that maybe they're desperate to get their music out there and stuff, how have you gone about making these singles?
In terms of like the creation of them?
Yeah, just like getting them, not even just writing them yourself and making them, but like actually getting them in a place where you can release them. And
yeah, so basically I should say as well, the new music is all myself and producers Jeff and Steph, and we've worked on all the new music together. They're Glasgow based, they're two amazing talented producers, and we've got a really good sort of connection in terms of how we work and stuff like that. So it's been really, felt really natural and organic the way the songs have been created. In terms of how it works is that I own the master rights to everything, not making that mistake again. And then basically I use a distribution service, probably similar to what you do with the podcast, to get the music out there. We royalty split everything, we publish and split everything. When those splits were agreed, when we very first started working together, if another collaborator comes involved, for example, there's a future song that's going to be out in August that is going to be remixed, so we then discuss with the remixer what the royalty split on that will be. And it's one of those nice things where it kind of happens through discussion. And
you have the control.
And we both have the control of it. Because if I say, well, I want 70 and 30, and then they say, well, actually, I think I deserve that, it's more of
making it into more of a... Yeah. It's almost more equal and fair.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's what I love about the script editing job as well, is that it's collaborative. Like, everything is collaborative. Like, the work that we do in scripts with writers and producers and people's notes and stuff like that, it's all done in a conversation of, well, I think this would work. Well, I think that could work, but we could do it this way. Like, that's the key for me in anything.
Collaboration. So important in the creative industries, and there's a lot of people that aren't very good at it, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. I think the collaboration in the music is what helped me be able to collaborate and script, because I learned in the recording studios that it's not about ego. Take your ego out of it and go, you can't just go, well, that was my original idea, and how dare you turn it into something else.
I think firstly, if you're a dick, then no one wants to work
with you. That's very true.
It's like, I think it's just, I'm more blunt with it now. Maybe like 100 episodes ago I'd be like, I'd wrap that up a bit, but I think it's true. Like, it comes up so often.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, some of the best writers I've worked with personally are all able to collaborate and work with a team well and let go of things. I think that must be the same in music as well. Like,
yeah,
I think it's good to have principles, and you should definitely fight for things, but you know, you've got to be able to
let go. I mean, at the end of the day, there's sometimes where I'll take a melody into the studio and the guys will go, we could maybe change that to this, or like, if we want to, you know, just being open as to get the best result. That's kind of what we do in script as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like,
completely.
It's all for the better of the script, and it's, for me and music, it's all for the better of the song. And at the end of it, I go, that was totally right. You were right to make that call, because
if you've got a good team, then it's always about like the what's best in the end. Like, we all want the same thing.
It's just about trust. Yeah.
Yeah, completely. What's the sort of plan for the music? What's next?
So the music, I'm really excited actually, because the first three songs have been great, but we're switching the tempo up a little bit for summer. So on the 7th of June I have a song coming out called As Against the World, and it's a real up-tempo fun summer banger. I basically said to Jeff and Steph, I want a song that's going to sound like a summer carnival on the 4th of July in America and whatever, and just fun vibes. So that's coming out, and it's a kind of pop rock punk type song. And then in August there is a proper 90s inspired dance banger, the one that I was saying might be remixed as well, and that's called Dark Bar, and that was inspired by a trip to Amsterdam where I opened my eyes to quite a few, things. So yeah, so fun stuff coming up with that, and then a live EP is coming out as well, which we're going to record in the summer at 45 Aside Recording Studios in Glasgow. So,
and do you think long term an album with all these singles? Or
I don't know. I'm not really. I was kind of told recently to try and avoid the album because do it single by single, see what people connect with, and go from there rather than put a whole body of work out at once.
That's interesting.
Because I want to start getting out and doing more live stuff as well, so that'll be a good gauge of what the audience connect to and more and stuff.
That's really exciting. Well, there's links in the show notes as well.
You'll be there singing to Untitled Love Song.
Yeah,
will
be. It's a great song. But links in the show notes for everyone that's interested. I'll start wrapping things up because I know we've been speaking for nearly an hour.
Cool.
But I also wanted to quickly ask, I know you lived in LA for a bit, we skipped over that because your dad, you know, a lot, they've done a lot of interesting things in your life, but quickly, like, what was, how was that? Like, did you move to LA for a bit? Did you just think?
Yeah, so I went over there to work. I was songwriting again at the time, and I just went over there to do some more work on that, basically build connections, do some sessions. And it was the last year of my 20s, so it was like, if I'm gonna do LA, I have to do it now. And yeah, I just kind of took the jump to go over and do it. LA is probably one of my favourite.
You got a tattoo
places.
Of it as well.
I got a tattoo of it on my neck, which was a very drunk night out while I was over there. But yeah, I had the best time, and I've been back a few times after, not for work purposes, but just because I made friends and stuff over there. And one of my best friends, who's originally from Clydebank, he lives over there now and is married to a guy over there. And so I try and get over when I can. The LA experience was amazing. I'd say it was just a wild time, but also work focused.
That was interesting. I just wanted to acknowledge it because, you know, London, LA, Liverpool, a lot of L's in your life.
A lot of L's, I know, and then back to Bonnybridge.
so it's all there. Obviously, mental health is a big part of, you know, I try to bring this up on the podcast every episode now. I like to call it mental fitness. I've been sort of talking about that a lot recently. I think it's a Simon Sinek, who's like a podcaster and stuff, that talked about this. I just think it's a nice way of calling it. Because you can train mental fitness. How do you sort of protect your mental well-being and stuff in such a full-on industry, especially working full-time in TV and then also doing the music stuff on the side?
Yeah, I mean, so for me, for the mental health thing is actually, like, the music thing is actually something that helps my mental health a lot. Because, and this sounds silly, but during COVID, I started taking singing lessons again because I really struggled in COVID because the world stopped. Whereas when you're busy, you keep going, you don't think about things. But because we all stopped, my brain caught, it was like my brain was catching up with things I had suppressed for so long. So I started doing singing lessons every week because I found that when I was concentrating on the singing, it shut me off from everything else, even just for an hour. So I try and still do that, and I walk a lot, and friends are the most important thing. I'm really lucky. I've had the same group of really close friends. Some of them are in London, some of them are here. We're all sort of spread out, but for me, they kind of keep me sane, and I know that I can phone any of them 3 a.m. if there's something going on or whatever. They're a big help to my mental health. I mean, it's up and down. I do struggle sometimes, as everyone does. Sometimes I have really good weeks, but I check in with myself, and I know that if I go quiet, I know that one of those friends will go, you've not been on the WhatsApp group in a while, what's going on? Because we just know each other so well. But yeah, a lot of walking, a lot of listening to music, vinyl shopping. I disappear when I'm digging through crates of vinyl. I love it.
So. When will I know better?
Thing for me to go this as well, like, what is the music you're into, what's been influencing?
Like, everything. I grew up, my mum was mad on Motown, 60s girl groups, and my dad loved Willie Nelson. Obviously, you know, I'm a massive Madonna fan.
I've seen her twice recently, haven't you?
Saw her twice recently, seen her, would follow her around the world if I could. And then, but there's, I mean, everyone has said, I went through a phase of being massively into electronic music. I love bands like the Mamas and the Papas. Like, I've got such a varied, I couldn't really, the only thing I would say I don't like is drum and bass and like proper heavy death metal. They're the only two things I'm not really into.
I feel that.
For me, other than that, I can find something in any other genre that I love.
I was in London last year and an Uber driver played drum and bass for the 1 hour journey home to our hotel, and it scarred me.
I think that's bad for my mental health, actually, listening to that.
Just on your mental health, I appreciate you being honest about that as well, and I think it sounds like you're able to put the music now, you've got quite a healthy relationship to it, so you're not driven by goals and numbers and stuff, and I think that's so important. Something I'm battling at the moment is constantly checking the podcast downloads and feeling bad when maybe people haven't engaged with it on socials, or you feel like not enough people are listening. It's reminding yourself that it's doing this right now, which is the most important thing, like having this connection conversation. You know, I hope people listen to it. I'm sure they will, especially some of our colleagues and stuff. But like, you know, it's just that relationship's really important, and I think it's good that you have got that connection now with the music.
But what you're doing is creating something that's, I said to you this before, like I find this podcast really important because it is opening up the world of the creative industries to people who don't know that certain jobs, or even just listening to other people's viewpoints on the jobs, you know, like it's really important. And I think whether or not someone discovered, for example, this episode or the episode you did 2 weeks ago, whether they discover it in that moment or a year, 2 years down the line, if it helps them at that point, that's the reason that you're doing it.
Yeah, and it's lovely because people go back and listen to old episodes and it's all there. It's like, you know, it's a resource. It's amazing to track your life as well.
Yeah, I mean,
look back 4 years ago and go, it must be the same with your songs. You're like, bloody hell, like, it's a different person 4 years ago. But I still had things to say at the time which are valuable and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is. I mean, keep going with it.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Don't get bogged down with the numbers, Jamie.
No, of course though. Just get a real job. I'll wrap things up. I've got two more questions for you. Obviously, the name of the podcast is Just Get a Real Job. We'd all have to work these sort of jobs to keep ourselves going. But what's the most memorable job you'd had to work in your time?
A good job or bad job?
Either. It could be either.
So, my jobs, I would say, in TV are some of my favourite jobs I've had. I loved being a barista because I loved just meeting different people every day. I was a barista in Costa Coffee on Old Compton Street in Soho. So you can imagine the characters rocking up there at 6 o'clock in the morning or similarly through the night. I was a flyer boy for GAY, which I kept getting fired from.
You were talking about this at lunch today. I was like, save this, I don't want to hear it.
I kept, so basically, I would get my flyers, I'd go out for half an hour, hand them out, bin the flyers, go clubbing, then show up like a brass neck and ask for my money. And the owner of the club would basically found out and fired me, but I think fancied me a little bit because I was only 17, and so kept rehiring me and then finding out and then firing me. And then, and then also I was a podium dancer for a while as well in Heaven Nightclub in London. So that was fun. Lots of free drinks. Lots of getting into clubs for free and stuff like that. So fun jobs. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to work in Costa probably wasn't very fun. And I worked in a train station once. Fuck. At Costa in a train station. And it kept getting robbed and it kept getting, like, I kept getting threatened to get mugged when I finished my shift and all that kind of stuff. These were all like London jobs back in the day. So a varied... I definitely don't take my nice cushy BBC script editing job for granted.
Not at all. Well, last question for you, and I'm sort of being cheeky because I'm going to add another question on, but what, like, your closing advice to anyone that maybe wants to either work as a script editor on TV or make music, but I'm also going to ask if you, what advice you would give to the young Adair that went to London all those years ago?
The young Adair, first of all, I would just say, do what you did, basically. Be determined. I was just kind of very strong-minded, and I think it's helped me along the way. Maybe went too far the other way sometimes. I put a lot of walls up, as you do when you're 16 and you're trying to protect yourself in a big city. But it did make me steely and determined, and it gave me the work ethic of get up, try again, get up, try again. Like, that's kind of what you also need to do if you want to work in either the music industry or the TV industry. Just take every opportunity that you can get. Say yes to everything because you're going to get something from it. And don't be obsessed with the numbers. Jamie.
And your closing advice just to anyone else that wants to work in that, would that be the same?
I would say that. I would say put yourself out there. Cold call, send emails. You know, basically, if you know that you want to work for X production, or you know that you want to work for X boss, whoever that is, just send them an email, introduce yourself, put yourself in alignment with your dreams. Mm-hmm. That's the only way that you're ever going to get closer to them. Don't put walls up. Don't allow other people to put walls up for you by saying, we have a really big thing we do in this country where, and that's the difference between LA, I would say, you tell someone in LA, I really want to be a screenwriter. They go, amazing. Oh my God. And I know someone who can help you. If you tell someone here want to be a screenwriter, unless they work in the industry, they're going to go, who is this?
Just get a real job.
No, I just get a real job. That's exactly it. Yeah. So I'd say keep at it and put yourself forward for everything and say yes to every opportunity that comes, if it's paying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a really good place to end on, but I really appreciate you sort of sitting down after work and chatting to me. It's been lovely getting to know more about your life and stuff, and you're a very determined, very hardworking person, and you know, it's a pleasure working with you every day.
Thank you, Jamie. It's been nice, it's been different, it's been unusual.
I was wondering how long the Catherine Kim references would take to come out.
I liked it, but I don't agree.
So for anyone that hasn't seen that show as well, go and check it. It's on Netflix.
Yes.
And go and check out Dare's music as well. Thank you very much, Adair.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there you go. That was episode 134 of Just Get a Real Job. Thank you again to Adair for chatting to us. Really, really enjoyed this chat. As I said in the intros and throughout the episode as well, be sure to check out Dare's music. There's links to that in the show notes. Keep your eyes peeled for what Adair's got coming up next as well. If you'd enjoyed this week's episode as well, be sure to give it a wee share on social media. You can tag us as well at Just Get a Real Job on X or on Instagram. I'm going to stop calling it X. It's called Twitter. Sorry, Elon, but it's called Twitter. Or you can also, drop us a message if you want to give us any feedback on the podcast. Leave a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. And we hope you have a wonderful end of the week. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Just Get a Real Job. And then after that, I think we're going to be taking a brief hiatus, but more details on that in next week's episode. But enjoy the rest of your week and have a good one. Just get a real job.